Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading from the June 8th, 2018 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows a U.S. Border Patrol officer on the right side of the cover. He's holding a child of about 5 or 6 in his arms, walking away from a woman who's obviously distraught, and it looks like maybe another officer's holding her back. And you can see a border wall in the background, and it says the title, Deliberate Cruelty, The Trump Administration's Policy of Separating Parents from Children at the Border. And that, in fact, is our lead main story. We'll start with that. Separating kids from parents at the border. What happened? A surge in the number of migrant children separated from their parents has sparked a furor over the Trump administration's new zero-tolerance policy on illegal border crossings. The policy was recently announced by Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who warned that all border violators, including those seeking asylum from Central American violence and drug gangs, would be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law, with their children placed in separate custody as a form of deterrence. If you don't like that, Sessions said, then don't smuggle children over our border. More than 700 minors, including toddlers and babies, were separated from parents at the border from October to April, and another 600 after the zero-tolerance policy went into effect in May. I cried. I begged, one 28-year-old Guatemalan father said, after having his 18-month-old son taken from him. When he asked where the boy was, quote, no one could tell me anything. In a tweet, President Trump blamed Democrats for a horrible law that separates children from their parents. Aide said the president meant that Democrats and the courts had created loopholes in immigration law that encouraged border crossings. The outrage over the separation policy was further stoked by a report that the federal government lost 1,475 children who had arrived at the border unaccompanied by a parent. But the Department of Health and Human Services said the report was misleading. It said it had resettled 7,635 children with family members or guardians in the U.S., called a month later to check up, and did not get responses from 1,475 guardians, some of whom may fear contact with the federal government. When officials call guardians and they don't answer the phone, said Steve Wagner, an acting assistant secretary at HHS, you don't assume that the children have been kidnapped. What the editorial said. Ripping wailing kids from their parents' arms is shocking, even for an administration as heartless as this one, said the Los Angeles Times. No law requires unauthorized border crossers to be charged with a crime, and White House Chief of Staff John Kelly let the mask slip when he admitted that splitting up families would be a tough deterrent. Separating parents and kids is a manifestly inhumane practice that may inflict lasting trauma on vulnerable kids. Trump is hardly the first president to come down hard on undocumented immigrants, said the Charlotte Observer. Presidents Bush and Obama each increased the rate of deportations, but both presidents pushed for Congress to pass comprehensive reform legislation that better recognized the value of all immigrants and the circumstances that brought many to our borders. Congressional resistance, specifically from Republicans, has left the country with a convoluted and contradictory immigration system. now run by a president whose rhetoric dehumanizes both illegal and legal immigrants. What the columnist said, "Separating kids and parents is regrettable," said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com, "but there is a significant moral cost to not enforcing the border. The Trump administration is facing a surge in women, children, and family units from Central America showing up at the border asking for asylum, releasing parents and kids into the U.S. while those asylum requests are adjudicated, is tantamount to allowing the migrants to live here, since they often just disappear. Kids can't legally be held for more than 20 days. That's why this policy is both unfortunate and necessary." So much for the party of family values, said Catherine Rampell in the Washington Post. Make no mistake, cruelty is not an unfortunate, unintended consequence of White House immigration policy. It is the objective. In some cases, the government is keeping migrant families forcibly separated even after court cases are over and parents are released or sent back to their home countries. Why? To inflict pain and deter others from coming. Even Trump supporters should admit that the process to which illegal migrant parents are subjected is disturbing, said Noah Rothman in commentary. It's dehumanizing to force a young mother wearing a yellow bracelet that identifies her as illegal immigrant parent watch as government agents drag away her children. This isn't about the rule of law. It's something far uglier. History will remember those who looked away. And we'll read a second main story today. Roseanne dropped over racist tweet. What happened? ABC canceled its highest rated show, Roseanne, this week after a racist tweet by the sitcom star provoked outrage on social media. Roseanne Barr described Valerie Jarrett, an Iranian-born African-American who served as former President Barack Obama's senior advisor, as if the Muslim Brotherhood and Planet of the Apes had a baby. Barr apologized for making a bad joke, but that failed to quell a firestorm of condemnation. Just hours after the offending tweet was posted, ABC dropped Roseanne, which averages 18 million viewers an episode. Channing Dungey, the network's entertainment president, called the tweet abhorrent, repugnant, and inconsistent with our values. Robert Iger, CEO of the Walt Disney Company, ABC's corporate parent, phoned Jarrett to apologize. A few hours after promising to leave Twitter, Barr returned to the site, retweeting statements by fans who blamed PC culture for her canning. "It was 2 a.m. and I was Ambien tweeting," Barr wrote, suggesting she was loopy from sleep medication. That excuse was widely mocked online, including by Ambien's manufacturer, whose CEO said, "Racism is not a known side effect." Roseanne returned to television in March after a 20-year hiatus, and President Trump repeatedly congratulated Barr, who played a Trump supporter on the show, on her high ratings. Asked whether Trump would weigh in on the cancellation, White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders said he was too busy. Not 24 hours later, Trump tweeted that Iger never called to apologize for the horrible statements made and said about me on ABC. Barr promptly retweeted him. What the columnist said. Barr is no victim of political correctness, said Catherine Temp in NationalReview.com. Likening an African-American woman to an ape is undeniably racist, and Barr was making crazy statements long before her sitcom was revived. She called 9/11 an inside job and the Boston Marathon bombing a false flag operation. Barr is indeed a toxic and troubled personality, said David French, also in NationalReview.com. But that doesn't make her punishment any less arbitrary. Fire one celebrity and you can dredge up six more who've posted their own deranged rants. When you make a supporter of a bigoted president a key character in your sitcom, racism is always going to rear its head, said Roxane Gay in NYTimes.com. Trump is the living embodiment of Barr's Twitter feed, and his most vocal supporters revel in the freedom and the permission he gives them to indulge in conspiracy theories and racism. Just before her tweeted attack on Jarrett, Barr falsely accused the Hungarian-born liberal donor George Soros of turning in his fellow Jews to be murdered during the Holocaust. That earned a retweet from Donald Trump Jr. "This is why we need Roseanne," said Emily Jashinsky in WashingtonExaminer.com. "Roseanne Barr and Roseanne Connor are different people, and the show's character helped audiences understand why decent people gravitated toward Trump. The demographic Connor it depicted is overwhelmingly misunderstood by Hollywood. That's why it's so unfortunate that Barr's tweet confirms the industry stereotypes of Trump supporters as racist deplorables, the very stereotypes Roseanne sought to debunk." Our controversy of the week is titled "Free Speech, the NFL's Kneeling Compromise." "The National Football League should be ashamed of itself," said Jonathan Capehart in WashingtonPost.com. "The NFL last week bowed down to the moral vacuum that is President Trump and announced a crackdown on players who kneel during the national anthem. That exercise of free speech began 2 years ago when small groups of players knelt before games to protest police shootings and mistreatment of black men. The deliberately divisive Trump turned the low-key protests into a national furor last year, saying any son of a bitch who dares to kneel should be fired and calling for a fan boycott. NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell and the league's owners have caved in, unveiling a new rule mandating that all team and league personnel on the field shall stand and show respect for the flag and the anthem. In what was billed as a compromise, players who don't wish to stand during the anthem can stay in the locker room, but any who take the field and kneel will see their team hit with stiff fines. Trump correctly saw this as a victory for his demagoguery, said Jonathan Chade in NYMag.com, triumphantly proclaiming that players who don't respect the flag shouldn't be in the country. This authoritarian rhetoric enthralls his base, which is offended by uppity black millionaires failing to show proper deference and gratitude. "This was purely a business decision," said Derek Hunter in USAtoday.com. "NFL viewership has plunged 17% since 2015, and while the brain injury problem is also a factor, the weekly spectacle of highly paid athletes disrespecting the flag created a swirling public relations disaster that the league had no choice but to address. As for free speech, the new rule leaves players 6 other days of the week and 21 other hours on the day of games to protest how and whatever they want. Free speech is a protected right," said Tom Joyce in WashingtonExaminer.com, "but having a job isn't. If NFL players won't help the league make a product that fans are willing to watch, they can seek employment elsewhere." "My fellow conservatives are a bunch of hypocrites," said David French in the New York Times. "When Google fired employee James Damore for his comments on gender differences, we rallied to his defense. We rightly decry the intolerance of dissent sweeping the nation's campuses. But now most conservatives gleefully applaud when the NFL shuts down the players' free speech and says, conform or face the consequences. Such corporate censorship is at odds with the culture of liberty conservatives supposedly support. In its militaristic pregame and halftime ceremonies, the NFL loves to drape itself in the nationalistic fervor of the flag," said Chris Clue in NBCNews.com. "Too bad the league has forgotten what the flag actually means. the right to protest against your government when you feel it has wronged you, whether the government likes it or not. Goodell's compromise will almost surely fail anyway, said Robert Silverman in the DailyBeast.com. Players are now required to show respect during the anthem, but what if players stand and raise a fist or link arms in solidarity? And if a substantial number of players remain in the locker room, many fans and Trump will see that as equally insulting to the troops. The NFL's owners should realize that with Trump whipping up near perpetual outrage in the MAGA crowd, the backlash against the kneeling players is never going away, regardless of what they do. And it's time for our Good Week, Bad Week segment. This week, it was a good week for undercounting. After a Texas woman who had been expecting triplets gave birth to quadruplets instead. Obstetrician Dr. Tony Dunn said he'd missed the fourth child in Vivian Van Gorder's ultrasounds because it really is hard to keep all the numbers of arms and legs straight. It was a good week for Hasbro after the toy company received a trademark for the distinctive scent of Play-Doh. The unmistakable odor is described as a sweet, slightly musky vanilla fragrance with slight overtones of cherry, combined with the smell of a salted, wheat-based dough. And it was a good week for overachievement when a North Dakota man who signed up to run a half marathon took a wrong turn, and completed a full marathon. Mike Kohler, age 26, said he realized his mistake, but decided, I'm just going to go for it. I'm already running. But it was a bad week for false alarms after officials in Lake Worth, Florida, apologized for sending out an emergency alert that said power was out due to extreme zombie activity. A spokesman said, I want to reiterate that Lake Worth does not have any zombie activity currently. And it was a bad week for the White House. After a retired English teacher corrected the errors and unsupported statements in a letter she'd received from President Trump and sent it back. Yvonne Mason of Atlanta said if a high school student had written the letter, I'd give it a D. And finally, it was a bad week for national security, with the news that several airmen at a nuclear missile base in Wyoming have been convicted of distributing and using LSD. Although this sounds like something from a movie, a military prosecutor said, it isn't. The briefing page article this week is titled The Crisis at Veterans Affairs. Every president says we must do more to care for veterans. What's stopping them? What's gone wrong? The Department of Veterans Affairs is struggling to meet the extremely ambitious mission. The massive agency's 350,000 employees provide medical care to 9 million vets at 170 hospitals and about 1,060 outpatient sites. Once veterans get to see a doctor, most of them rate the system's care as good to excellent. The VA's medical staff specializes in state-of-the-art treatment for spinal cord injuries, amputations, burns, post-traumatic stress disorder, and other serious injuries. But the department has long been overwhelmed by its patient load and hampered by paperwork and red tape. As a result, Veterans can wait weeks or even months for treatment. The VA is now caught in a power struggle over whether to privatize the care of veterans. In March, President Trump fired Secretary of Veterans Affairs David Shulkin, who was resisting more privatized care, and tried to replace him with White House physician Ronnie Jackson, who had to withdraw because of allegations of misconduct. Though Trump has nominated Acting Secretary Robert Wilkie to do the top job, many senior officials have left the agency amid the crisis in leadership. "I've been doing this 30 years, and it's the worst it's ever been," said Dr. Murray Altos, who recently retired as chief of staff at a VA hospital in Cleveland. When was the VA created? It began as the Veterans Bureau in 1921, created by President Warren Harding and Congress to care for neglected veterans of World War I. From the start, the department has been plagued by scandals and complaints of inefficiency. The Bureau's first director, Charles Forbes, was convicted of embezzlement and kickbacks. In 1947, after thousands of World War II vets failed to receive services, a government commission uncovered enormous waste, duplication, and inadequate care in the VA system and called for major reforms. In 1984, investigators found the VA had failed to spend $40 million approved by Congress for Vietnam veterans. More recently, the VA has struggled with outrageously long waiting lists, even for basic treatment. Why the backlog? The wars in Afghanistan and Iraq increased the number of VA patients by nearly 2 million. Many suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder or serious physical injuries. Though the department employs 20,000 physicians, there are often not enough to deal with the huge patient load, and the VA's size makes it slow to react to staffing vacancies. Veterans groups say Congress deserves some of the blame since it made the approval process for benefits maddeningly complicated. Had there been reform efforts? Many. During the 1990s, the VA began using performance data to monitor the timeline of care, but that resulted in some VA hospital staffers fudging data to hide continuing delays. In 2014, an investigation found a secret list at a VA hospital in Phoenix revealing that 1,700 veterans had waited an average of 115 days for an initial primary care appointment, rather than the target of 14 days. The report said the problem was systemic and counted 93 VA medical facilities with falsified waiting lists. At a subsequent congressional hearing, Representative Jackie Walorski, Republican from Indiana, cried, "This is an outrage. This is an American disaster." Did the outrage bring change? Some. Veterans Secretary Eric Shinseki, resigned. By a bipartisan vote, Congress passed the CHOICE Act in 2014, which provided $10 billion for veterans to receive care from private doctors. Under the program, vets who have to wait more than 30 days for a doctor's appointment or live more than 40 miles from a VA facility can get private sector care at taxpayer expense. Now 1 million vets each year utilize CHOICE. But in 2016, a congressional commission found the CHOICE Act had actually aggravated wait times and frustrated veterans because of its confusing eligibility requirements and long delays in payments to doctors. "The CHOICE program has been a wreck," said Senator John Tester, Democrat from Montana. "Every veteran will tell you that." Is privatization the future? Trump has aligned himself with Concerned Veterans for America, a group backed by the libertarian Koch brothers. Although the CVA avoids the word privatization, it seeks to dramatically expand CHOICE. Veterans view this with suspicion. A poll by the Veterans of Foreign Wars found that 92% of vets would rather see the current system improved than dismantled and turned over to private doctors, who, they say, often lack the expertise to treat veterans' unique problems. But in a bipartisan compromise, Congress last week approved a bill that would provide $5.2 billion to keep the Choice program running for another year as part of a comprehensive $52 billion reform bill to review the VA's performance, consolidate its facilities, and institute needed reforms. Dr. Robert Pearl, a Stanford University professor and former VA doctor, said that the partisan battle over privatizing care should not get in the way of fixing the VA itself. Those who have risked their lives to fight for our freedom and democracy deserve outstanding medical care, Pearl said. I believe it's our government's job to make that possible. And we'll read a few of the best columns of the week. The first from the U.S. is titled, The Truth About Weed and the Brain. It may make sense to legalize marijuana, said neuroscientist Judith Grissel. But Americans are being astoundingly naive about how the widespread use of pot will affect communities and individuals, particularly teenagers. The research on marijuana's effects on the brain show that the ingredient that causes its high, Delta 9 THC, can indeed dampen motivation and interfere with a successful life, as well as lead to tolerance, dependence, and craving, the hallmarks of addiction. In particular, the research on THC's impact on the developing adolescent brain is inconveniently alarming. Teens who smoke weed regularly, studies show, have reduced activity in the brain circuits critical to noticing new information and making decisions. They are 60% less likely to graduate from high school, are at substantially increased risk for heroin addiction and alcoholism, and are 7 times more likely to attempt suicide. Recent studies even show that THC can turn on or off genetic expression in a teenager's epigenome, making young users children at increased risk for mental illness and addiction years before they are conceived. Yes, it's true that alcohol and tobacco also have caused great damage, but let's not pretend that marijuana is benign or beneficial. And let's not pretend that legalizing weed will be without cost. This is from Austria. Data rules just hurt the little guy. Hooray for the European Union for trying to strike a blow against big American corporations, said Martina Salomon. Alas, like so many big European projects, the attempt was smothered in red tape. The EU's General Data Protection Regulation, GDPR, went into effect last week, forcing companies to spam us all with emails detailing their new privacy policies and the option to opt out of sharing information. The idea behind the regulation, protecting ordinary citizens' data, is noble. Companies that sell or give away user information without permission will now be slapped with painful fines of up to 4% of revenues. But in practice, GDPR just benefits the behemoths, because Facebook and Google users want to remain on those platforms, they'll blindly accept pages and pages of terms and conditions. The little companies, though, those you can easily opt out of. That means little firms will increasingly turn to those same massive corporations to reach their customers. Meanwhile, unlike emerging European data companies, the big U.S. companies have cohorts of lawyers whose only job is to get around such regulations. We are, at least, all now talking about data privacy, but we haven't protected it. Instead, a well-intentioned EU regulation has morphed into a bureaucratic monster, harassing millions and hurting the wrong people. And our last column comes from Nigeria. Marauding herdsmen must be stopped. Nigeria's government is finally waking up to the bloody crisis in the country's most fertile farming region, said Vanguard. While the Boko Haram terrorists in the north grab international headlines, a murderous campaign is underway in the south. Muslim Fulani herdsmen have been marauding through Christian farming villages for months now, torching churches and barns, slaughtering families, and sending thousands fleeing to refugee camps. The herdsmen say climate change has left them with nowhere to graze their cattle in their northern homeland, so they have traveled south in search of new pastures. In a major failure of government, federal authorities did nothing while the attacks raged. But in the past few weeks, since President Muhammadu Buhari returned from his Washington meeting with President Donald Trump, troops have entered the area. Some herdsmen have been arrested and disarmed. That effort must continue until all bandits, be they armed herdsmen, cattle rustlers, or ethnic militias, are stamped out, and the refugees have returned and been compensated for their losses. Of course, there is no way of achieving these noble objectives without spending money. Lots of it. The $27 million the government has allocated so far will be a mere drop in the basin. Time for our in-depth article, The Last Word. This week it is titled, The Life of a Female Pool Shark. Billiards has long been considered a man's game, said writer Megan Greenwell. But that hasn't stopped a tight-knit tribe of elite female players who suffer through long hours and bad pay for love of the sport. Renee Mata is a 4'11" ball of irrepressible good vibes. She never stops grinning and stops talking only slightly more often. So when she takes a break from shooting pool one Saturday morning in mid-January to tell me, still smiling, that she's in a funk, I honestly can't tell if she's joking. 30-year-old Mata, Ren to her friends, is one of 30 women at Billiard Palisade, a dark pool hall in Balboa Park, one of the last ungentrified neighborhoods in San Francisco. And there's nowhere she'd rather be. But the funk is very real. She didn't get much sleep last night because she didn't get home from work, pouring beers and cooking hot dogs at another pool hall until 2:30 a.m. Now it's time to compete at the penultimate stop in what may be the most competitive regional women's pool tour in the country. These girls are all my friends, but they're also crazy good pool players, Mata tells me, fresh off a streak of 8 consecutive hugs with her competitors. So if I'm not on top of my game because I didn't get enough sleep or didn't eat right or didn't have a good practice session last night, I'm going to have a rough day. The event is the 8th stop on the West Coast Women's Tour, a series with monthly events across Northern California. The tour focuses on 9-ball billiards, in which players must use the cue ball to strike the lowest numbered of the balls on the table. Top performers will qualify for the annual American Pool Players Association Championships in Las Vegas in August, and several of the regulars travel widely for bigger competitions. But the California Tour is not just for elite players. The women at Billiard Palisade range in age from their teens to their 70s, and the spread of skill levels is at least as wide. A handicap system encourages women of all abilities to participate. The pro player who co-founded the event in 2007 has to win 8 games to win a match, while the newbie must win just 5. Mata falls somewhere in the middle. For the past 5 years, her life has revolved around pool. She quit her job managing a Bay Area Target store when she convinced the owner of her favorite pool hall to hire her, so she practices nearly every day at work. She plays in a team league as well as on the women's tour. When she was a kid, her dad loved watching pool on TV, and she dreamed of playing professionally, too. But the only pool halls near their home were inappropriate for little girls, so she didn't start playing regularly until she was 23, when her brother's girlfriend asked her to join her team. She wasn't very good, she admits, but her drive to improve was insatiable. 2 days earlier, Mata told me she thinks of this particular tournament as more of a fun time than a competition. "This is my girls' weekend with no boyfriends or men at all. But make no mistake, she is here for a prize." When the draw is announced and players move to their assigned tables, even the bubbliest player in the room goes mum, the smile suddenly gone from her face. She racks the balls into the diamond shape that begins a game of nine ball. As the tournament begins, 6 20-something men who have just walked in look crestfallen. The women are using all 15 tables, so there's no room for them to play. Women have been playing billiards since the sport's earliest days, when it was a hobby for European royals in the 15th century. Mary, Queen of Scots, complained about being deprived of the game while imprisoned, and her body was covered with the cloth from her billiards table after her execution in 1587. But until the 1970s, there were few women's tournaments, and decorum prevented most female players from spending time in pool halls with men. In 1934, a Pennsylvania woman named Ruth McGinnis was named Queen Billiard Player of the World by the World Billiards Association after winning a series of games against both men and women in Chicago, but she retired more than 10 years before the creation of the first national tournament for women in 1967. 8 years after that, two players seeking to give women more opportunities to compete without being intimidated by more experienced male players created the Women's Professional Billiard Alliance, now the Women's Professional Billiard Association, the first governing body for women's events. In 1981, two professional male players developed the first governing body for amateur pool players, the American Pool Players Association. Looking to encourage more casual players to compete, the pair developed a handicap system that would give rookies a chance at beating more established players in co-ed recreational tournaments. Before the 1990s, competitive events for female pool players were rare in the U.S., though more common in Asia and Europe, where pool is a more mainstream sport. Female players who are now in their 30s and 40s say they were routinely discouraged from playing as children, whether by men who refused to take them seriously or by protective parents who refused to let their young daughters hang out in smoke-filled pool halls frequented by older men. Eleanor Collado, who co-founded the West Coast Women's Tour with her twin sister, Emmeline, in the early 2000s, is now an internationally ranked pro on the WPBA circuit, was introduced to the game by her father as an 8-year-old growing up in the Bay Area. But she and her sister only got to play twice before their mother put a stop to it. The second time, he got us home at like 3 in the morning, and she's like, "No, never again," Collado, now 33, tells me. Their mother relented when the twins were 13 and began playing in junior tournaments, but not everyone was so understanding. For their 16th birthday, shortly before Collado won her first junior national tournament, they invited 12 girls to a local pool hall for a party with a DJ and a catered meal. Not one showed up. Their parents wouldn't allow it. Many female players attribute the evolution of pool's once seedy image to ESPN, which broadcast women's championships in the 1990s and 2000s. The number of WPBA events grew from a few per year to as many as 10 or 12. And Lyle says the share of female players in APA leagues grew from 15% to about 35%. The spotlight also made Jeanette Lee, the top-ranked female player in the world during much of that time, into a household name. She was known for the slinky cocktail dresses she wore while playing and for her nickname, the Black Widow. We wanted so hard to class it up and pull the sports reputation up from backroom smoky bars and all that, so some of us went to the extreme of dressing up and making it a classy event, which the men didn't have to do. Lee, now 46, tells me from her home in Tampa, the more we were on TV, the events and prize money just skyrocketed. A decade ago, though, ESPN moved women's pool from its TV channels to its internet streaming service. The network cited poor viewership. Women in the industry say they could never get a consistent time slot, so it was hard to build a fan base. That change, combined with the economic downturn, struck a blow to the sport's growth. Lyle says revenue plunged for the WPBA, of which she is a board member, and the number of pro women's tournaments dropped from 10 a year in the early 2000s to just one as recently as 2016. The industry is beginning to bounce back. The WPBA is hoping to host 5 or 6 events this year and at least 8 in 2019. But while the decline in exposure has not led to fewer American women playing pool overall, it has made it virtually impossible to earn a living doing it, let alone become a celebrity like the Black Widow. Collado, who was ranked 13th in the world in 2016, earns less than $5,000 a year in prize money. Her endorsements cover equipment, but not travel costs or entry fees. These days, the reason women-only billiards tournaments exist is not because players like Mata can't beat men. It's because they can. While APA events and other casual tournaments are typically co-ed, every serious female player has an arsenal of stories about less skilled men disrespecting them, harassing them, and mansplaining the game. Mata says she won't play in bars anymore because it's not worth dealing with comparatively low-skilled men who suddenly think they're sharks once they start drinking. A 2-day pool tournament with no men allowed represents as much of a safe space as any fiercely competitive sporting event can. Just $300 is up for grabs at the West Coast Women's Tour stop at Billiard Palisade. But the top eight finishers will earn points that will boost their rankings and help them qualify for larger tournaments. For the best amateur players, the goal is the APA Championships, a chance to measure their skills against players from across the country. For the rest, it's simply the most fun way to spend a weekend. This is Ren Mata's last chance to earn points. She has to miss February's tournament, the last of the season, because she has a competition with her league team the same weekend. She has been competing seriously on the women's tour for 3 years now, and she plans to spend the 3 months before the start of next season practicing daily so she can improve her standing in 2019. Even if she doesn't end up going pro, she tells me, she wants to be able to play at the next level. A random draw has matched Mata against Motoko Siguenza, the same higher-ranked player she had to face in the last tournament. Ah, why can't I get someone I can beat when I'm tired, she mock yells. The effects of her funk are visible almost immediately when she scratches on an easy shot early in the first game of the match, setting up her opponent for a run of 5 balls. Siguenza, though, misses a clean shot on the 9 ball, giving Mata a straight shot to win the opener. She misses. Siguenza takes the game, and Mata begins racking the balls again with no visible reaction. She loses the match 6-3. The tournament is double elimination, though, and Mata's second match pits her against an obviously weaker player, whose handicap means she just has to win 5 games before Mata wins 6. Mata wins the first game easily, but gives away enough points to leave the match tied at 3-3. Then in Game 7, she makes a rookie mistake. She sinks the 9 ball but scratches a cue ball, an automatic loss. She does the same in the next game, giving away the match. She grimaces performatively, throwing her hands into the air. But once she's out of the competition, She starts grinning and playing on an empty table almost immediately. I told you it wasn't my day, she says. On Collado's advice, she plans to skip the second chance bracket for eliminated players tomorrow in favor of a co-ed tournament with a $1,000 prize. 8 hours into the first day of play, I get a first-hand glimpse at the annoyances that come with being a woman in the often macho pool world. Only half of the tables in the room are being used for the tournament at this point, but Mata and several other eliminated players aren't tired yet, so they're playing friendly matches on the rest. A handful of men are milling around, irritated that there's still no space for them. I am watching Collado dominate a match when a middle-aged man sidles up next to me and begins critiquing her form. That was a very amateurish mistake, he scoffs when she misses a bank shot. I'm not the one he's criticizing, and I've known Collado for all of a day, but I find myself fuming. She's an internationally ranked pro, I snap. He's taken aback, stammering something about how she's not that highly ranked this year. She'll go on to win the tournament fairly easily, but her real focus is on a pro event in Michigan a couple of weeks later. One ignorant guy isn't going to stop her from having a good time. That's sort of the point of all this, she says, gesturing around the room at the event she founded more than a decade ago. I mean, how cool is it that you get all these women in a male-dominated sport and just get to pretend the men don't exist for a weekend? This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in Topic, topic.com. And a couple of short pieces on the health and science page this week. First, the benefits of eating fish. Concerns about mercury contamination should not dissuade Americans from eating seafood, the American Heart Association has announced. Recent research has found that large fish such as ahi tuna and swordfish contain high levels of metal, which is toxic to the brain and nervous system. Mercury enters the atmosphere through coal burning and other industrial activity, eventually making its way into lakes and oceans. But studies have also found that seafood helps prevent heart disease, reports MedicalDaily.com. After reviewing all the available data, the AHA concluded that the significant cardiovascular benefits of eating fish outweigh the neurological risks. In an updated scientific advisory, the organization advises adults to consume 2 3.5-ounce servings of non-fried fish every week, and specifically recommends salmon, trout, sardines, and other oily fish that are rich in heart-healthy omega-3 fatty acids. The benefits of fish, said Harvard epidemiologist Eric Rim, who chairs the group that wrote the advisory, are likely at least 50-fold more than the concerns over other compounds that may be in fish. And the health scare of the week, germs lurking in hotel pools. As summer gets underway, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has issued a stark warning for travelers. Beware of the hotel pool. Between 2000 and 2014, nearly a third of the disease outbreaks linked to recreational water facilities occurred at hotels, inns, and lodges. Cryptosporidium, or crypto, was the culprit behind 58% of the outbreaks with a confirmed source. This parasite, which wreaks havoc on the digestive system, is highly tolerant of chlorine and can survive for days in well-maintained pools and hot tubs. Swallowing just a mouthful of water with crypto in it can make otherwise healthy kids and adults sick for weeks with watery diarrhea, stomach cramps, nausea, and vomiting, the CDC's Michelle Alvassa tells CBSNews.com. Legionella bacteria, which can cause pneumonia, accounted for 16% of the reported outbreaks. 13% involved Pseudomonas, a group of bacteria responsible for hot tub rash and swimmer's ear. The CDC advises people to avoid getting pool water in their mouths, to shower before swimming, and avoid pools when sick with diarrhea. And we are on the Talking Points page. We have an article here called Birth Rates. Why aren't Americans having babies? Americans are less inclined than ever, it seems, to be fruitful and multiply, said Jeff Jacoby in the Boston Globe. The U.S. fertility rate hit a record low in 2017, according to alarming new data, with 60.2 births per 1,000 women of childbearing age. We've dropped below the replacement fertility rate of 2.1 births for each woman of childbearing age to 1.7 births. That should trouble anyone who hopes that America's best days are yet to come. In Japan and other countries, plummeting birth rates have led to economic stagnation and social malaise, with fewer workers to replenish a shrinking labor force and care for the elderly. This slump began, somewhat predictably, during the Great Recession, said Christine Imba in the Washington Post. Birth rates usually decline during recessions and rebound once things improve. But so far, that hasn't happened. So, what is holding up the stork? The answer seems obvious to me, said Amy Westervelt in The Guardian. The U.S. is a remarkably harsh place for families, and particularly for mothers. It's one of the few countries in the world without government-subsidized maternity leave, and only 56% of private companies provide maternity leave. Mothers who want or need to work can also look forward to an increasingly large pay gap for every child they have, plus fewer promotions, as well as painful child care costs. In 33 states and Washington, D.C., average child care costs now exceed the price of in-state college tuition. Want more babies? Make it easier to be a parent. It's never been easy to be a parent, said Michael Brendan Doherty in NationalReview.com, but people used to have large families anyway. Now upwardly mobile professionals think any couple with more than two kids is weird, and that worldview is contagious. I wouldn't be surprised if America's fertility rate began crashing to the depths seen in Russia and Central Europe after the Cold War. One solution is to bring in more immigrants to fill jobs and pay taxes, said Olga Kazan in Atlantic.com, but that can bring a nationalistic backlash. Recent research shows that as immigrants replace dwindling native-born populations, many people become more xenophobic and thus more inclined to support nationalist parties. But without immigration, the same communities shrink, age, and decline, fueling even more hopelessness and resentment. It's a doom loop that only more babies can fix. Weinstein, invulnerable no more. It could just as well have been the red carpet as cameras flashed and reporters shouted, "Harvey, Harvey," said Kevin Fallon in thedailybeast.com. But with a sinister grin, Harvey Weinstein was turning himself in for arraignment at a Manhattan police precinct, where he was charged with raping an unnamed woman and forcing actress Lucia Evans to perform a sex act on him. For decades, the powerful Hollywood producer appeared invulnerable, and the sight of him in handcuffs was a major victory for the Me Too movement, which began last fall when more than 80 women came forward to accuse Weinstein of sexual abuse. His transformation from mogul to perp is a watershed moment, said Melena Rizek in the New York Times. This prosecution should send a clear message to abusers everywhere. Stop behaving badly, or beware the consequences. Sadly, it's no mystery why Weinstein arrived with a smirk, said Maureen Callahan in NYPost.com. He strode into court knowing he'd stride right back out after paying $1 million to post bail, and his ultimate fate remains far from certain. His attorney, Benjamin Braffman, successfully defended Dominique Strauss-Kahn against sexual assault charges, and says Weinstein fully expects to be exonerated. Brofman even had the gall to tell the judge, Mr. Weinstein did not create the casting couch in Hollywood, indicating the defense will claim that the director's accusers knowingly traded sex for stardom. Still, Weinstein is in real trouble, said Eliana Doctorman in Time.com. Authorities in Los Angeles and London are also looking into various allegations of assault, and Weinstein faces a federal investigation and nearly a dozen lawsuits. Many of Weinstein's accusers could be asked to testify to establish a pattern of bad behavior, a strategy that helped convict Bill Cosby. Until recently, monsters like Cosby and Weinstein were nearly impossible to prosecute, said attorney Caroline Polisi in CNN.com. They would put their accusers on trial and use their vast resources to muddy the issue of consent. But Me Too has brought about not just a cultural, but also a legal inflection point. Accusations of sexual assault and harassment against powerful men have a new credibility, bolstered by the willingness of multiple women to testify about what they endured. Me Too has fundamentally altered our collective consciousness, and in the end, Weinstein's victims may just wipe that smirk off his face. And we'll wind up now with, actually, we have time for two quotes. We'll start with one from George Orwell, who says, whoever is winning at the moment will always seem to be invincible. And the second from former President George W. Bush, family values don't stop at the Rio Grande. And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Please be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. Questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138.